Kemla, Bob said. Right. The lights came to rest on the other end of the table in the shape of a perfect sphere. What do you want to know, wizard? I watched the lights warily, but nothing seemed all that wrong, other than the fact that Bob was suddenly calm and geometric. Tell me what the word of Kemler is. The lights pulsed scarlet. Knowledge. Truth. Power. I said, a little more specific. The master wrote down his teachings, wizard, so that those who came after him could learn from him, could learn about the true power of magic. You mean, I said, so that they could learn about necromancy. Bob's voice took on the edge of a sneer. What you call magic is nothing but a mound of parlor tricks beside the power to master life and death itself. That's an opinion, I guess, I said. More than that, Bob said, it is a truth. A truth that reveals itself to those who seek it out. What do you mean? I said slowly. There was a flash, and a pair of white eyes formed in the glittering cloud of red points of light. They weren't pleasant. Shall I show you the start of the path? Bob's voice said. Death, Dresden, is a part of you. It is woven into the fabric of your being. You are a collection of pieces, each of them dying, and in turn being reborn and remade. The white lights were cold, not mountain spring cold either, graveyard mist cold, but I'd never seen anything quite like them before. And there was no sense interrupting Bob when he was finally spilling some information. Besides, fascinating light. Dead flesh adorns you even now. Nails, hair. You tend them and caress them like any other mortal. Your women decorate them, entice with them. Death is not a thing to be feared, boy. She is a lover who waits to take you into her arms. You can feel her if you know what her touch is like. Cold, slow, sweet. He was right. A cold, tingling, non-feeling was glittering over my fingernails and my scalp. For a second, I thought that it hurt, but then I realized that it was only a shivering sensation where that cold energy brushed close to the blood pulsing beneath my skin. It was where they met that it felt uncomfortable. Without the blood, the cold would be a pure, endless sweetness. Take a little of death inside, boy, and it would lead you to more. Open your mouth. I did. I was staring at the light in any case, and it was amazing enough to merit a bit of gaping. I barely noticed a frozen mote of dark blue light, like the corpse of a tiny star, that appeared from one of the spirit's white eyes and began drifting toward my mouth. The cold sensation grew, and it hit my tongue like a thermonuclear peppermint, freezing hot, searingly bitter and sweet and wrong. I spat it out, recoiling, throwing my arms up in front of my face. I fell to the floor, numbness spreading. Too late, crowed the spirit. It shot into the air, swirling around over me, gloating. Whatever you have done to my thoughts, the master will not be pleased that you have meddled with his servant. The cold started spreading, and it wasn't purely physical. There was an empty, heartless void to it, a starless, frozen quality that raked at me, not just my body, but me, with a mindless hunger. And I could feel it sending tendrils out through me, slowing my heartbeat, making it impossible to breathe. Do you know how long I've been waiting for that? The spirit purred, drifting back and forth over me. Sitting there, locked behind my own thoughts, waiting for the chance to fight free. Finally, you thick-witted ogre, I'd get to leave your stupidity behind. Bob, I choked out. This conversation is over. The spirit's scarlet lights flared to sudden incandescent rage, and it screamed, a wailing sound that rattled my shelves and felt like it was splitting my head. Then the cloud was ripped backward across the room, sucked into the eye holes of the skull as though down a hellish drain. Once the last of the motes went flickering back into the skull, the horrible cold faltered a little, and I curled up, focusing my will and trying to push it away. It took me a while, and that hideous, void presence lingered against my fingernails, even after I could feel my fingers again, but after a little while I was able to sit up. After that, I just curled up my knees against my chest, shocked and scared half out of my mind. I had always known that Bob was an incredibly valuable asset, and that no spirit with as much knowledge as he had could be weak. But I had not been all that prepared for the sheer power he had wielded, or for the malice with which he did it. Bob wasn't supposed to be a sleeping nightmare waiting to wake up. Bob was supposed to be my wisecracking Portageek. Good Lord. I couldn't remember the last time I'd confronted a demon with that much raw psychic power. If I'd been a second slower, or stars and stones, if I hadn't remembered the condition that would banish Bob back to the skull and once again remove the dark memories, I'd be dead now. Or maybe dead and then some. And it would have been my own stupid fault, too. Harry? Bob said. I flinched and let out a small squeaking sound. Then I got hold of myself and blinked up at the skull. It rested on its shelf, and its orange-gold eye lights were back to their usual color. Oh, hey. Bob's voice was very quiet.
Your lips are blue.
Yeah.
What happened? Bob asked.
It got kind of cold in here.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Harry, Bob said. I tried to tell you.
I know, I said.
I had no idea. Kemna was bad, Harry, Bob said. He took what I was, and he twisted it. I destroyed most of my memories of my time with him, and I locked away everything I couldn't, because I didn't want to be like that.
You won't, I told him quietly. Now hear this, Bob. I command you never to recover those memories again, never to let them out again, never to obey any command to unleash them again. From here on out, they sleep with the fishes, understand me?
If I do, Bob said carefully, I won't be able to do much to help you, Harry. You'll be on your own.
Let me worry about that, I said. It's a command, Bob. The skull let out a slow sigh of relief.
Thank you, Harry.
Don't mention it, I said. Literally.
Right, he said.
Okay. Let's see, I said. Can you still remember general information about Kemler?
Nothing you couldn't find in other places, but general knowledge I learned when Justin was with the Wardens, yes.
All right, then. You, that is the other you, said that Kemler had written down his teachings when I asked him what the word of Kemler was, so I figure it's a book.
Maybe, Bob said. Council records stated that Kemler had written three books, The Blood of Kemler, The Mind of Kemler, and The Heart of Kemler.
He published them?
Self-published, Bob said. He started spreading them around Europe.
Resulting in what?
Way too many penny anti-sorcerers getting their hands on some real necromancy.
I nodded. What happened?
The Wardens put on their own epic production of Fahrenheit 451, Bob said. They spent about 20 years finding and destroying copies. They think they accounted for all of them.
I whistled. So if the word of Kemler is a fourth manuscript...
That could be bad, Bob said.
Why?
Because some of Kemler's disciples escaped the White Council's dragnet, Bob said. They're still running around.
If they get a new round of necro-at-home lessons to expand their talents, they could use it to do fairly horrible things.
They're wizards?
Black wizards, yes, Bob said.
How many?
4 or 5 at the most, but the warden's information was very sketchy.
Doesn't sound like anything the wardens can't handle, I said.
Unless what's in the 4th book contains the rest of what Kemmler had to teach them, Bob said.
In which case, we might end up with 4 or 5 Kemmlers running around.
Holy crap, I said. I plunked my tired ass down on my stool and rubbed at my head.
And it's no coincidence that it's almost Halloween.
The season when the barriers between the mortal realm and the spirit world will be weakest, Bob said.
Like when that asshole the Nightmare was hunting down my friends, I said. I peered at Bob.
But for him to do that, he had to weaken the barriers even more. He and Bianca had tormented all those ghosts to start making the barriers more unstable.
Would it have to be ghosts to stir up the kind of turbulence you'd need for big magic?
No, Bob said. But that's one way. Otherwise you'd have to use some rituals or sacrifices of one kind or another.
You mean deaths, I said.
Exactly.
I frowned, nodding. They'd have to invest some energy early to get things moving for a big necromantic working, like bouncing on a diving board a couple of times before you jump.
An accurate, if crude, aphorism, Bob said. You'd have to do a little pre-work if you wanted to start working Kemmler-level necromancy, even on Halloween, he sighed.
Though that doesn't really help you much.
I got up and headed for the stepladder.
It helps more than you know, man. I'm getting you new romances.
The skull's eyelights brightened.
You are? I mean, of course you are. But why?
Because if someone's setting up for a big bad juju, they'll have left bodies. If they've done that, then I have a place to start tracking them and finding out what's going on.
Harry, Bob called up as I left the lab,
where are you going?
I stuck my head back down the trapdoor and said,
the morgue.
Chapter 4.
Chicago has a bitchin' morgue. You can't call it a morgue anymore because it's the Forensic Institute now. It isn't run by a coroner either, because now it's a medical examiner. It's on West Harrison Street, which is located in a fairly swanky industrial park, mostly specializing in various biotech industries. It's pretty. There are wide green lawns, carefully kept and trimmed, complete with sculpted trees and bushes, a fantastic view of the city's skyline, and quick access to the freeway. It's upscale, sure, but it's also very quiet. Despite the gorgeous landscaping and the more antiseptic naming scheme, it's where they bring the dead to be poked and prodded. I parked the Blue Beetle in the visitors' parking lot of the complex next door. The morgue had more than average security, and I didn't want to advertise my presence. I grabbed my bride from the back seat and headed for the front door of the office of the medical examiner. I knocked, flashing my little laminated card I got from the police that makes me look like an official police-like person. The door buzzed, and I went in, nodding to a comfortably heavy-set security guard reading a magazine behind a nondescript desk to one side of the entry area. Phil, I said.
Evening, Dresden, he said. Official?
I held up the wooden box packed with McAnally's microbrew.
Unofficial. Hosanna, drawled Phil. I like unofficial better.
He put his feet back up on the desk and opened up his magazine again. I left the beer on the floor next to the desk where it would be out of sight from the door.
How come I never heard of this bar?
Just a local tavern, I said. I didn't add that caters to the supernatural community and doesn't exactly try to attract the attention of locals.
I'll have to get you to take me by sometime.
Sure, I said. Is he here?
Back in the slabs, he said, reaching down for one of the ales.
Phil opened the lid with a thumb and took a swig, eyes on his magazine again.
Ah, he said, his tone philosophical. You know, if anyone had come through that door, I tell him to get his ass going before someone drives up or something.
Gone, I said, and hurried back into the hallways behind the entry area.
There were several slabs, I mean examination rooms, in the morgue. That is, the Forensic Institute. But I knew that the guy I was looking for would be in the smallest, crummiest room, the one farthest away from the entrance. Waldo Butters, other than having the extreme misfortune of being born to parents with little to no ability to bestow a manly name upon their son, had also been cursed with a sense of honesty, a measure of integrity, and enough moral courage to make him act on them. When he'd examined the corpses of a bunch of things I'd burned mostly to briquettes, he'd pronounced them human-like but definitely non-human in his report. It was a fair enough description of the remains of a bunch of bat-like Red Court vampires, but since everyone knew that there were no such things as human-like non-humans, and the remains were obviously human corpses that had been horribly twisted by intense heat, Butters wound up sitting in a psych ward for 90 days for observation. After that, he had been forced to wage a legal battle just to keep his job. His superiors didn't want him around, and they handed him the worst parts of the job they could come up with. But Butters stuck it out. He mostly worked the overnight shift and weekends. It had the happy side effect of producing an M.E. who regarded the establishment with the same sort of cheerful disrespect I myself occasionally indulged in, which was damned handy when, for example, one needed a bullet removed from one's arm without intruding upon the law enforcement community's busy schedule. The doctor was in. I heard polka music oompaing cheerfully through the hall as I approached the room, but the music was off somehow. Butters normally played his polka records and CDs loud, and I'd gotten used to hearing the elite performers of the polka universe. Whoever he was playing now sounded admirably energetic, but lumpy and uneven. There were odd jerks and breaks in the music, though the whole of it somehow managed to hang on the rhythm of a single bass drum. On the whole, it made the music happy, lively, and somehow misshapen. I opened the door and regarded the source of the Quasimodo polka. Butters was a little guy, maybe 5'3" in his shoes, maybe 120 pounds soaking wet. He was dressed in blue hospital scrubs and hiking boots. He had a shock of wiry black hair that gave him a perpetual look of surprise that stopped just short of being a perpetual look of recent electrocution. He was wearing Tom Cruise sunglasses and had transformed himself into Polkastein. A bass drum was strapped to his back, and a couple of wires ran to his ankles from a pair of beaters mounted on a frame. The drum beat in time to stomps of his feet. A small but genuine tuba hung from his slender shoulders, and there were more strings attached to his elbows, which moved back and forth in time to the and pa, respectively. He held an accordion in his hands, strapped to the harness on his chest. A clarinet had been clamped to the accordion so that the end was near his mouth, and there was, I swear to God, a cymbal on a frame held to his head. Butters marched in place, red-faced, sweating, and beaming as he thumped and oompawed and blared accordion music. I just stood there, staring, because while I have seen a lot of weird things, I had never seen that. Butters wrapped up the polka and energetically banged his head against the tuba, producing a deafening clash from the cymbal. The motion brought me into his peripheral vision, and he jumped in surprise. The motion overbalanced him, and he fell amidst the clatter of cymbal, a honk of tuba, a fitful stutter of drum, and then lay on the floor while his accordion wheezed out. "Butters," I said.
"Harry," he panted from the pile of polka. "Cool pants."
"I can see you're busy."
He missed the sarcasm. "Heck yeah. Gotta get set. Oktoberfest Battle of the Bands tomorrow night."
"I thought you weren't going to enter after last year."
"Ha," Butters said, sneering defiantly. "I'm not going to let the Jolly Rogers laugh at me like that. I mean, come on. 5 guys named Roger. How much polka can be in their souls?"
"I have no freaking clue," I answered, truthfully. Butters flashed me a grin.
"I'll get them this year."
I couldn't help it. I started smiling. "Need any help getting out of there?"
"Nah, I got it,"
he said brightly, and started unstrapping himself.
"Surprised to see you. Your checkup isn't until next week. Hand bothering you?"
"Not really," I said. wanted to talk to you about...
Oh, he said. He hopped up from the stuff and left it on the floor so that he could scamper toward a desk in the corner. Before you get started, I found something interesting.
Butters, I said, I'd like to chat, man, but I'm in a pretty big hurry. He paused, crestfallen.
Really?
Yeah, it's a case, and I need to find out if you know anything that could help me.
Oh, he said. Well, you have cases all the time. This is important. I've been doing a lot of research since you started seeing me about your hand, and the conclusions I've been able to extrapolate from...
Butters, I sighed. Look, I'm in a huge hurry. 5 words or less, okay? He leaned his hands on his desk and regarded me, eyes sparkling.
I know how wizards live forever.
He paused for a thoughtful second and then said,
Wait, that's 6 words. Never mind, then. What did you want to talk about?
My mouth fell open. I shut it and glared at him. No one likes a wise ass, Butters. He grinned.
I told you it was important.
Wizards don't live forever, I said. Just a really long time. Butters shrugged and kept pulling out file folders. He flicked on a backlight for reading X-ray films and started pulling them from the folders and putting them on the light.
Hey, I'm still not sure I buy into this whole hidden world of magic thing. But from what you've told me, wizards can live 5 or 6 times as long as the average human. That's closer to forever than anyone I know. And what I've seen makes me think there must be something to it. Come here.
I did, frowning at the X-rays.
Hey, aren't these mine?
Yep, Butters confirmed. After I switched to one of the older machines, I got about 15% of them to come out, he said.
And there are 3 or 4 from your records that managed to survive whatever it is about you that screws up X-rays.
Ugh. This is that gunshot wound I got in Michigan, I said, pointing at the first. It showed a number of fracture lines in my hip bone where a small caliber bullet had hit me. I just barely avoided a shattered pelvis and probable death. They got this one after they got the cast off.
Right, Butters said. And here, this is one from a couple of years ago. He pointed at a second shot. See the fracture lines? They're brighter where the bone refused, leaves that signature.
Right, I said. So?
So, Butters said, look at this one.
He flipped up a third X-ray. It was much like the others, but without any of the bright or dark lines. He flicked it with a finger and looked at me, eyes wide.
What?
I asked. He blinked slowly. Then he said,
Harry, this is an X-ray I took 2 months ago. Notice the lack of anything wrong?
So, I asked, it healed, right? He made an exasperated sound.
Harry, you are dense. Bones don't do that. You carry marks where they refused for the rest of your life. Or rather, I would. You don't.
I frowned. What's that got to do with wizard lifespan? Butters waved his hand impatiently.
Here are some more. He slapped up more X-rays. This is a partial stress fracture to the arm that didn't get shot. You got it in that fall from the train a couple of nights after we met, he said. It was just a crack. You didn't even know you had it, and it was mild enough that it just needed a splint for a few days. It was off before you were ambulatory.
What's so odd about that?
Nothing, Butters said. But look, here it is again. There's the fuse marker, and in the third one, poof, it's gone. Your arm is back to normal.
Maybe I just drink too much milk or something, I said. Butters snorted.
Harry, look, you're a tough guy. You've been injured a lot.
He pulled out my medical file and thumped it down with a grunt of effort. Granted, there are phone books smaller than my hospital file.
And I'm willing to bet you had plenty of boo-boos you never saw a doctor about.
Sure, I said.
You're at least as battered as a professional athlete, Butters said. I mean, like a hockey player or a football player. Maybe as much as some race car drivers.
They get battered? I asked.
When you go around driving 0.5 ton of steel at 1/3 the speed of sound for a living, you get all kinds of injuries, he said, seriously. Even the crashes that aren't spectacular are pretty vicious on the human body at the speeds they're going. Ever been in a low-speed accident?
Yeah, sore for a week.
Exactly, Butters said. Multiply that. These guys and other athletes take a huge beating, right? They develop a mental and physical toughness that lets them ignore a lot of pain and overcome the damage. But the damage gets done to their bodies nonetheless. And it's cumulative. That's why you see football players, boxers, a lot of guys like that, all beat to hell by the time they're in their 30s. They regain most of the function after an injury, but the damage is still there. And it adds up bit by bit. Again, I ask, what's that got to do with me? You aren't cumulative, Butters said. Huh? Your body doesn't get you functional again and then leave off, Butters said. It continues repairing damage until it's gone. He stared at me. Do you understand how incredibly significant that is?
I guess not, I said.
Harry, that's probably why people age to begin with, he said. Your body is a big collection of cells, right? Most of them get damaged or wear out and die. Your body replaces them. It's a continual process. But the thing is, every time the body makes a replacement, it's a little less perfect than the one that came before it.
That copy of a copy thing, I said. I heard about that, yeah.
Right, Butters said. That's how you're able to heal these injuries. It's why you have the potential to live so long. Your copies are perfect. Or at least a hell of a lot closer to it than most folks.
I blinked. You're saying I can heal any injury?
Well, he said, not like mutant X-factor healing. If someone cuts an artery, you're going to bleed out. But if you survive it, given enough time, your body seems to be able to replace things almost perfectly. It might take you months, even several years, but you can get better when other people wouldn't.
I looked at him, and then at my gloved hand. I tried to talk, but my throat wouldn't work.
Yeah, the little doctor said quietly. I think you're going to get your hand back at some point. It didn't mortify or come off. There's still living muscle tissue there. Given enough time, I think you'll be able to replace scar tissue and regrow the nerves.
That, I said and choked up. I swallowed. That would be nice.
We can help it along, I think, Butters said. Physical therapy. I was going to talk to you about it next visit. We can go over it then.
Butters, I said. Wow, man, this is
really exciting, he said,
eyes gleaming. I was going to say amazing, I said quietly. And then I was going to say thank you.
He grinned and twitched a shoulder in a shrug. I calls them like I see them. I stared down at my hand and tried to twiddle my fingers. They sort of twitched.
Why? I asked.
Why what?
Why am I able to make good copies?
He blew out a breath and pushed his hand through his wiry hair, grinning. I have no freaking clue. Neat, huh? I stared down at the X-ray film for a moment more, then put my hand in my duster's pocket.
I hope you could get me some information, I said.
Sure, sure, Butters replied. He went to his POCA suit and started taking it apart. Is something going on?
I hope not, I said. But let's just say I've got a real bad feeling. I need to know if there have been any odd deaths in the area in the past day or two.
Butters frowned.
Odd how?
Unusually violent, I said, or marks of some kind of murder method consistent with a ritual killing. Hell, I'll even take signs of torture prior to death.
Doesn't sound like anyone I've met, Butters said.
He took off his sunglasses and put on his normal black-rimmed glasses. Though I'm not done for tonight. Let me check the records and see who's in the his house.
Thank you, I said.
Butters knocked a few flyers off his chair and sat down. He dragged a keyboard out from under a medical magazine and gave me a significant look.
Oh, right, I said. I backed away from his desk to the far side of the room.
Proximity to me tended to make computers malfunction to one degree or another. Murphy still hadn't forgiven me for blowing out her hard drive, even though it had happened only the once. Butters got on his computer.
No, he said, after a moment's reading and key thumping.
Wait. Here's a guy who got knifed, but it happened way up in the northwest corner of the state.
No good, I said. It would have to be local, within a county or three of Chicago.
Huh, Butters said. You investigative types are always so picky about this kind of thing.
He scanned over the screen. Drive-by shooting victim? Definitely no, I said. For a ritual killing, it would be a lot more intimate.
Think you're out of luck then, Harry, he said. There were some high-profile stiffs that came in, and the day crew took them all.
Hmm. Tell me about it. I got stuck with a wino, and some poor bastard that got caught under a tractor and had to be tested for drugs and booze earlier tonight. But that's...
He paused. Hello?
Hello?
That's odd.
That perked up my ears, metaphorically speaking.
What's odd?
My boss, Dr. Brioche, passed over one of his subjects. It got moved to my docket, but I didn't get a memo about it. Not even an email, the bastard.
I frowned. That happened a lot?
Attempts to make it look like I'm neglecting my job so he can fire me?
Butters said.
That one's new, but it's in the spirit of my whole history here.
Maybe he was just busy today.
And maybe Liv Tyler is waiting in my bedroom to rub my feet,
Butters responded.
Heh, who's the stiff?
A Mr. Eduardo Anthony Mendoza, Butters read. He was in a head-on collision with a Buick on the expressway, only he was a pedestrian.
Butters scrunched up his nose.
Looks like it will be a nasty one. No wonder high and mighty Brioche didn't want to handle it.
I mused. It wasn't what I was looking for, but there was something about the situation around that corpse that set off my internal alarm bells.
Mind if I ask you to indulge in intuition?
Sure. I'm as polka-empowered as I'm gonna get anyway. Let me break out my gear, and we'll take a look-see at the late Eddie Mendoza.
Cool, I said. I leaned against the wall and folded my arms, preparing to settle in for a while.
The door to the examination room slammed open, and Phil, the security guard, walked in with a businesslike stride. Except Phil's throat had been slit open from ear to ear, and blood covered his upper body in a sheet of ugly splatters. His face was absolutely white. There was no chance whatsoever that poor Phil was alive. That didn't stop him from striding into the room, seizing Butter's desk, and throwing it, computer, heavy file cabinet, and all, into the far wall of the room, where it shattered with a thunderous sound of impact. Butters stared at Phil with horror, then let out a somewhat rabbit-like shriek and scurried back from him.
Don't move,
thundered a deep, resonant voice from the hallway outside. Dead Phil froze in his tracks. A big man in a khaki trench coat and, I swear to God, a dark fedora strode into the room, intent on Butters, and he didn't see me against the wall. I hesitated for a second, still shocked at the suddenness of it all. Three other men in coats, all gray of face and purposeful of motion, flanked him.
"Don't hurt the little coroner, gentlemen," the man said. "We'll need him. For a little while."
Chapter 5 The man in the fedora took a step toward Butters, drumming a slender book against his thigh with one hand. "Stand aside," he muttered, and Dead Phil sidestepped. Butters had scrambled back into a corner, his eyes the size of glazed donuts behind his glasses.
"Wow," he babbled. "Great entrance. Love the hat."
The guy in the fedora took a step forward and reached out with his other hand, at which point I decided to act. A raised hand isn't much in the regular world, but from a guy in a long coat with his own flock of zombies, it had to be at least as menacing as pointing a gun.
"That will be enough,"
I said, and I said it loud enough to hurt ears. I stepped away from the wall with my left hand extended. My silver bracelet of heat-warped shields hung on my wrist, and I readied my will, pushing enough power into the bracelet to prepare a shield to leap up immediately. The bracelet was still pretty banged up from the beating it had taken the last time I'd used it, and I'd only barely gotten it working again. As a result, it channeled the energy pretty sloppily, and blue-white sparks leapt out and fell to the floor in a steady drizzle. "Put your hand down and step away from the coroner." The man turned to face me, book thumping steadily against his leg. For a second I thought he was another dead man himself, his face was so pale. But spots of color appeared high on his cheeks, faint but there. He had a long face, and though it was pale, it was leathery, as if he'd spent years in the blowing desert wind and sand without seeing the sun. He had dark eyes, thick gray sideburns, no beard, and a scar twisted his upper lip into a perpetual sneer. "Who," said the man, his accent thick and British, "are you?" "The Great Pumpkin," I responded. "I've risen from the pumpkin patch a bit early because Butters is just that nifty." "And you are?" The man studied me in silence for a long second, eyes focused on my sparkling wrist, then on my throat, where my mother's silver pentacle amulet was probably lying outside my shirt. "You may call me Gravain. Walk away, boy." "Or what?" I said. Gravain gave me a chilly little smile, thumping his book, and nodded at his unmoving companions. "There's room in my car for one more." "I've got a job already," I said. "But there's no reason for this to get nasty. You're going to stand right there while Butters and me leave." "And I," he said, his voice annoyed. "Was that?"
"Butters and I, fool. Do you seriously think that a defensive shield barely held together by a clumsy, crude little focus will intimidate me into allowing you to leave?"
"No," I said, and drew my .44 revolver from my duster's pocket. I pointed it at him and thumbed back the trigger. "That's why I brought this." He lifted his eyebrows.
"You intend to murder me in Cruar Gelidus?"
"No, I'll do it right here," I said. "Butters, get up. Come over here to me." The little guy hauled himself to his feet, shaking, and edged around the empty, staring gaze of the late Phil. "Good," I said. "This is moving along nicely, Gravain. Keep it up, and I won't need to make forensics pick your teeth out of that wall behind you." Butters scuttled over to me while Gravain thumped his book on his leg. The necromancer stared at me, barely sparing a glance for Butters. Then a slow and fairly creepy smile spread over his face.
"You are not a warden."
"I flunked the ridden." His nostrils flared.
"Not one of the council's guard dogs. You are, in fact, more of my own persuasion."
"I really doubt that," I said. Gravain had narrow yellow teeth and a crocodile's smile.
"Don't play games. I can smell the true magic on you."
The last person to talk about true magic had been Necro Bob. I had to fight off a shiver. I guess that's the last time I buy generic deodorant."
"Perhaps we can make an arrangement," Gravain said. "This need not end in bloodshed, particularly not now, so close to the end of the race. Join me against the others. A living lieutenant is far more useful to me than a dead fool."
"Tempting," I told him in the voice I usually reserve for backed-up toilets. Butters got to me, and I bumped him toward the door with my hip. He took the hint instantly, and I sidestepped to the door of the room with him. I kept my eyes and my gun on Gravain, my readied bracelet drizzling heatless sparks to the floor. "But I don't think I like your management technique. Butters, check the hall." Butters bobbed his head out and looked nervously around.
"I don't see anyone."
"Can you lock that door?"
Keys rattled.
"Yes," he said. "Get ready to do it," I said. I stepped out in the hall, slammed the door shut, and snapped,
"Lock it! Hurry!"
Butters fumbled with a key. He jammed one in the door and turned it. Heavy security bolts slid to, with a comfortably weighty snap, an instant before something heavy and solid hit the door, hard enough for me to feel the floor rattle through my boots. A second later, the door jumped again, and a fist-sized dent mushroomed half an inch out of its center.
"Oh, God!" Butters babbled. "Oh, God! That was Phil! What is that? What is happening?"
"Right there with you, man," I said. I grabbed him and started walking down the hall as quickly as I could drag the little guy. "Who else has keys to the door?"
"What?"
Butters blinked for a second.
The other doctors. Day security, and Phil."
The door rattled again, dented again, and then went silent.
"Gravain's figured that out, too," I said. "Come on, before he finds the right key. Do you have your car keys with you?"
Yes. Wait. Oh, yes. Right here," Butters said,
His teeth were chattering together so loudly that he could barely speak clearly, and he stumbled every couple of steps.
God! Oh, God! It's real!
In the halls behind us, metal clicked and scraped on metal. Someone was trying keys in the lock. Butters, I said. I grabbed his shoulders and had to resist the urge to slap him in the face, like in the movies. Do what I tell you. Stop thinking. Think later. Move now, or there won't be a later. He stared at me, and for a second I thought he was going to throw up. Then he swallowed, nodded once, and said,
Okay.
Good. We run to your car. Come on. Butters nodded and took off for the front of the building at a dead sprint. He accelerated a lot faster than I did, but I have long legs, and I caught up pretty quickly. Butters stopped to hit the buzzer at the guard station, and I held the door open wide enough to let him out first. He turned right and ran for the parking lot, and I was only a couple of feet behind him. We rounded the corner of the building, and Butters dashed toward a pint-sized pickup truck parked in the nearest space. I followed him, and after the silence of the morgue, the night sounds of the city were a blaring music. Traffic hissed by in an automotive river on the highway. Sirens sounded in the distance, ambulance rather than patrol car. Somewhere within a 200-mile radius, one of those enormous, thumping bass stereos pounded out a steady beat, almost too low to hear. The light in the parking lot was out, making everything dark and hazy, but the scent of gasoline came sharp to my nose, and I seized Butters' collar and pulled. The little guy choked and all but fell down, but stopped.
Don't,
I said, and slipped my fingers under the pygmy truck's hood. It flipped up, already open. The engine had been torn apart. A snap drive belt hung out like the tongue of a dead steer. Wires were strewn everywhere, and finger-sized holes had been driven into plastic fluid tanks. Coolant and windshield cleaner still dribbled to the parking lot's concrete, and from the smell of it they were mixing with whatever gasoline had been in the tank. Butters stared at it with wide eyes, panting.
My truck! They killed my truck!
Looks like, I said, sweeping my gaze around.
Why did they kill my truck?
That heavy bass stereo kept rumbling through the October night. I paused for a second, focusing on the sound. It was changing, getting a little bit higher pitched with each beat. I recognized what that meant, and panic slammed through my head for a second. Doppler effect. The source of the rumbling bass was coming toward us. In the darkness of the industrial park's lanes, a pair of headlights flashed on, revealing a car accelerating toward the Forensic Institute. The lights were spaced widely apart. An older car, and judging by the sound of the engine, some kind of gas-guzzling dinosaur, like a Caddy or a Big Olds.
Come on,
I snapped to Butters, and started running to the lot next door, back to the Blue Beetle. We'd already been spotted, obviously, so I fired up my shield bracelet again, so that my hand looked like it had been replaced with a small comet. Butters followed, and I had to give the little guy credit. He was a good runner.
There!
I shouted.
Get to my car! I see it!
Behind us, the rumbling Cadillac swerved into the Institute's parking lot and lurched over a concrete-encased grassy median, sparks flying from its undercarriage. The car roared up onto the grass and skidded to a broadside stop. The door flew open, and a man got out. I got a half-decent glance at him in the backwash of the Caddy's headlights. Medium height at most, long, thinning hair, and pale, loose skin with a lot of liver spots. He moved stiffly, like someone with arthritis, but he hauled a long shotgun out of the car with him and raised it to his shoulder with careful deliberation. I juked to one side so that I was directly between the driver and Butters, twisted at the hips, extended my arm behind me, and raised my shield. It flickered to life in a ghostly half-dome just a second before one barrel of the shotgun bloomed with light and thunder. The shield flashed and sent off a cloud of sparks the size of a small house. I felt it falter through the damaged bracelet on my wrist, but it solidified again in time to catch the second blast from the gun's other barrel. The old man with the shotgun howled in wordless outrage, broke the barrel, and started loading in fresh shells. Butters was screaming, and I was yelling right along with him. We got to the Beetle and piled in. I stomped the engine to life, and the Beetle sputtered once, and then gamely took off at its best clip. I screeched out of the parking lot and onto the road, started to skid, turned into it, fishtailed once, and then shot off down the street.
Look out!
Butters screamed, pointing. I snapped a glance over my shoulder and saw Phil and the other three dead men from the examining room sprinting across the grounds at us. I don't mean they were running. It was a full-out sprint, faster than Phil could have done even in the prime of his life. I stomped on the gas and kept my eyes on the road. The beetle lurched, and Butters cried out, "Holy crap!" I looked back again and saw dead Phil clinging to the back of the car. He had to have been standing on the rear bumper. The other three dead men weren't far behind him, keeping up with the car. Dead Phil drove his hand down at the back of the beetle, and there was a wrenching sound of impact, then a series of snaps and squeals as he tore the back cover from the car, exposing the engine.
"Take the wheel!"
I shouted to Butters. He reached over and seized the steering wheel. I twisted and thrust my right hand at dead Phil. I focused my attention on the plain silver ring on my middle finger. It was another focus, like the shield bracelet, one designed to store back a little kinetic energy every time I moved my arm. I focused on the ring, clenched my hand into a fist, and shoved it directly at dead Phil, releasing the energy within. Dead Phil had raised his arm again, this time to tear apart the beetle's engine, but I beat him to the punch. The unseen force, unleashed from the ring, hit him at the top of his thighs, kicking his whole lower body out straight. The force tore his grip loose from the car, and he tumbled away, hitting the street with heavy, crunching sounds of impact, arms and legs splayed. The other dead men ran past him, one leaping clear over, and dead Phil lay twitching on the ground like a broken toy. I got back to the wheel and shifted the car into the next gear. In my rearview mirror, I saw the leading dead man spring at us again, but he missed the car by a couple of feet, and I left the rest of them behind in the darkness, scooting out of the industrial park and onto public streets. I drove for a while, taking a lot of unnecessary turns. I didn't think anyone was pursuing us, but I didn't want to take the chance that the old man might have gotten back into his caddy and onto our tails. Maybe 10 minutes went by before I started breathing easier, and I finally felt safe enough to pull over into a well-lit convenience store parking lot. I started shaking as soon as I set the parking brake. Adrenaline does that to me. I usually get along just fine when the actual crisis is in progress, but after it's over, my body makes up for the lost terror. I closed my eyes and tried to keep my breathing slow and calm, but it was a fight to do it. There wasn't anything I could do about the trembling. It had been getting harder and harder to maintain my composure ever since the battle where I nearly lost my hand. The emotions I'd always felt seemed to be hitting me harder and harder lately, and sometimes I had to literally close my eyes and count to 10 to keep from losing control. Right then, I wanted to scream and howl, partly in joy at being alive and partly in rage that someone had tried to kill me. I wanted to call up my power and start laying waste with it, to feel the raw energy of creation scorching through my thoughts and body, mastered by raw will. I wanted to cut loose. But I couldn't do that. Even among the strongest wizards on the planet, I'm no lightweight. I don't have the finesse and class and experience that a lot of the older practitioners do, but when it comes to raw metaphysical muscle, I rank in the top 30 or 40 wizards alive. I had a ton of strength, but I didn't always have the fine control to go with it. That's why I had to use specially prepared articles such as my bracelet and my ring to focus that power. Even with them, it wasn't always easy to be precise. The last time I had surrendered my self-control and really cut loose with my power, I burned as many as a dozen people to scorched skeletons. I had a responsibility to keep that destructive strength in check, to use it to help people, to protect them. It didn't matter that I still felt terrified. It didn't matter that my hand was screaming with pain. It didn't matter that my car had been mutilated yet again, or that someone had tried to kill one of the few people in town I considered a real friend. I had to hold back, be careful, think clearly.
"Harry?"
Butters asked after a minute.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah. Just give me a minute."
"I don't understand this," he said.
His voice didn't sound any too steady either.
"What just happened?"
"You don't want to know," I said.
"Yes, I do."
"Trust me," I said. "You don't want to be involved in this kind of business."
"Why not?"
You'll get hurt. Or killed. Don't go looking for trouble.
He let out a frustrated, neighing sound.
Those people came for me. I didn't go looking for them. They were looking for me.
He had a point. But even so, Butters was not someone I would want to see involved in a conflict between people like Gravain and his dead men and his liver-skinned partner. Mortals usually didn't fare too well when it came to tangling with preternatural bad guys. In my day, I'd seen dozens of men and women die from it, despite everything I did to help them.
This is unreal, Butters said. I know you and Murphy have talked about this black magic supernatural stuff a lot, and I've seen some things that are tough to explain, but I never imagined something like this could happen.
You're happier that way, I said. Hell, if I could do it, I might want to forget I ever found out about any of it.
I'm happier being scared?
He asked, almost timidly.
I'm happier wondering if maybe my bosses were right the whole time, and I really am insane? I'm happier being in danger and having no idea what to do about it?
I didn't have a quick answer for that one. I stared at my hands. The trembling had almost stopped.
Help me understand this, Harry, he said. Please?
Well, damn it.
I raked the fingers of my right hand through my hair. Gravain had been after Butters, specifically. He had backup waiting outside, and he trashed Butters' truck to make sure the little guy couldn't escape. He openly said that he needed Butters, and needed him in one piece to boot. All of which meant that Butters was in very real and very serious danger. And by now I've learned that I can't always protect everyone. I screw up sometimes, like everyone else. I make stupid mistakes. If I kept quiet, if I forced Butters to wear blinders, he wouldn't be able to do jack to protect himself. If I made a bad call and something happened to him, it would be my fault that he didn't have every chance to survive. His blood would be on my hands. I couldn't take that choice away from him. I wasn't his father or his guardian angel or his sovereign king. I wasn't blessed with the wisdom of Solomon or the foresight of a prophet. If I chose Butters' path for him, in some ways it would make me no different from Gravain or any number of other beings, human and non-human alike, who sought to control others. If I tell you this, I said quietly, it could be bad for you.
Bad? How?
It could force you to keep secrets that people would kill you for knowing. It could change the way you think and feel. It could really screw up your life.
Screw up my life?
He stared at me for a second and then said, deadpan,
I'm a 5'3", 37-year-old, single Jewish medical examiner who needs to pick up his lederhosen from the dry cleaners so that he can play in a one-man polka band at Oktoberfest tomorrow.
He pushed up his glasses with his forefinger, folded his arms, and said,
Do your worst.
The words were light, but there was both fear and resolve just under the surface of them. Butters was smart enough to be scared, but he was also a fighter. I could respect him for both. Okay, I said. Let's talk.
Chapter 6
Butters hadn't taken time to collect his coat when he left, and the last time the Beatles' heater had worked was before the demolition of the Berlin Wall. I ducked into the store, got us each a cup of coffee, then untwisted the wire that holds down the lid of the storage trunk. I dug out a worn but mostly clean blanket that I kept in the trunk to cover the short-barreled shotgun I stored in the event that I would ever need to give Napoleon's charging hordes a taste of the grape. Given the way the night was going, I got the shotgun too and slipped it into the back seat. Butters accepted the blanket and the coffee gratefully, though he shivered hard enough to slop a little of the drink over the side of the cup. I sipped a little coffee, slipped the cup into the holder I'd rigged on the car's dashboard, and got moving again. I didn't want to wait around in the same place for too long. All right, I told Butters. There are two things you have to accept if you want to understand what's going on.
Hit me.
First, the tough one. Magic is real. I could feel him looking at me for a moment.
What do you mean by that?
There's an entire world that exists alongside the everyday life of mankind. There are powers, nations, monsters, wars, feuds, alliances, everything. Wizards are a part of it. So are a lot of other things you've heard about in stories, and even more you've never heard of.
What kind of things?
Vampires, werewolves, fairies, demons, monsters. It's all real. Butters said.
You're joking, right?
No joke. Come on, Butters. You know that there are weird things out there. You've seen the evidence of them. He pushed a shaking hand through his hair.
Well, yes, some. But, Harry, you're talking about something else entirely here. I mean, if you want to tell me that people have the ability to sense and affect their environment in ways we don't really understand yet, I can accept that. Maybe you call it magic, and someone else calls it ESP, and someone else calls it the Force, but it's not a new idea. Maybe there are people whose genetic makeup makes them better able to employ these abilities. Maybe it even does things like make them reproduce their DNA more clearly than other people, so that they can live for a very long time. But that's not the same thing as saying that there's an army of weird monsters living right under our noses, and we don't even notice them.
What about those corpses you analyzed, I said. Humanoid, but definitely not human.
Well, Butters said defensively, it's a big universe. I think it's sort of arrogant to assume that we're the only thinking beings in it.
Those corpses were the bodies of vampires of the Red Court, and you don't want to meet a living one. There were a lot of them in town at one point. There aren't so many now, but there are plenty more where they came from. They're only one flavor of vampire, and vampires are only one flavor of supernatural predator. It's a jungle out there, Butters, and people aren't anywhere near the top of the food chain. Butters shook his head.
And you're telling me that nobody knows about it?
Oh, lots of people know about it, I said. But the ones who are in the know don't go around talking about it all that much.
Why not?
Because they don't want to get locked up in the loony bin for 3 months for observation, for starters.
Oh, Butters said, flushing. Yeah, I guess I can see that. What about regular people who see things, like sightings and close encounters and stuff?
I blew out a breath. That's the second thing you have to understand. People don't want to accept a reality that frightening. Some of them open their eyes and get involved, like Murphy did, but most of them don't want anything to do with the supernatural, so they leave it behind and don't talk about it, don't think about it. They don't want it to be real, and they work really hard to convince themselves that it isn't.
No, Butters said. I'm sorry, I just don't buy that.
You don't need to buy it, I said. It's true. As a race, we're an enormous bunch of idiots. We're more than capable of ignoring facts if the conclusions they lead to make us too uncomfortable or afraid.
Wait a minute. You're saying that the whole world, multiple civilizations of scientific study and advancement and theory and application, all based around the notion of observing the universe and studying its laws, is what? In error about dismissing magic as superstition?
Not just in error, I said. Dead wrong. Because the truth is something that people are afraid to face. They're terrified to admit that it's a big universe, and we're not. He sipped coffee and shook his head.
I don't know.
Come on, Butters, I said. Look at history. How long did the scholarly institutions of civilization consider Earth to be the center of the universe? And when people came out with the facts to prove that it wasn't, there were riots in the streets. No one wanted to believe that we all lived on an unremarkable little speck of rock in a quiet backwater of one unremarkable galaxy. The world was supposed to be flat, too, until people proved that it wasn't by sailing all the way around it. No one believed in germs until years and years after someone actually saw one. Biologists scoffed at tales of wild beast men living in the mountains of Africa, despite eyewitness testimony to the contrary, and pronounced them utter fantasy. Right up until someone plopped a dead mountain gorilla down on their dissecting table. He chewed on his lip and watched the streetlights. Time after time, history demonstrates that when people don't want to believe something, they have enormous skills of ignoring it altogether.
You're saying that the entire human race is in denial, he said.
Most of the time, I replied. It's not a bad thing. It's just who we are. But the weird stuff doesn't care about that. It keeps on happening. Every family's got a ghost story in it. Most people I've talked to have had something happen to them that was impossible to explain. But that doesn't mean they go around talking about it afterward, because everyone knows that those kind of things aren't real. If you start saying that they are, you get the weird looks and jackets with extra long sleeves.
For everyone, he said, his voice still skeptical. Every time. They just keep quiet and try to forget it.
Tell you what, Butters, let's drive down to CPD, and you can tell them how you were just attacked by a necromancer and four zombies. How they nearly outran a speeding car and murdered a security guard who then got up and threw your desk across the room. I paused for a moment to let the silence stretch. What do you think they'd do?
I don't know, he said.
He bowed his head.
Unnatural things happen all the time, I said. But no one talks about it, or at least not openly.
The preternatural world is everywhere. It just doesn't advertise.
You do, Butters said.
But not many people take me seriously. For the most part, even the ones who accept my help just pay the bill, then walk out determined to ignore my existence and get back to their normal life.
How could someone do that?
Butters asked.
Because it's terrifying, I said.
Think about it. You find out about monsters that make the creatures in the horror movies look like the Muppets, and that there's not a damn thing you can do to protect yourself from them. You find out about horrible things that happen, things you would be happier not knowing. So, rather than live with the fear, you get away from the situation. After a while, you can convince yourself that you must have just imagined it, or maybe exaggerated it in the remembering. You rationalize whatever you can, forget whatever you can't, and get back to your life.
I glanced down at my gloved hand and said, It's not their fault, man. I don't blame them. Maybe, he said. But I don't see how things that hunt and kill human beings could be there among us without our knowing.
How big was your graduating class in high school? Butters blinked.
What?
Just answer me.
About 800.
All right, I said. Last year, in the U.S. alone, more than 900,000 people were reported missing and not found.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I said. You can check with the FBI. That's out of about 300 million total population. That breaks down to about one person in 325 vanishing every year. It's been almost 20 years since you graduated, so that would mean that between 40 and 50 people in your class are gone. Just gone. No one knows where they are. Butters shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
So?
I arched an eyebrow at him. So they're missing. Where did they go?
Well, they're missing. If they're missing, then nobody knows.
Exactly, I said. He didn't say anything back. I let the silence stretch for a minute, just to make the point. Then I started up again. Maybe it's a coincidence, but it's almost the same loss ratio experienced by herd animals on the African savanna to large predators. Butters drew his knees up to his chest, huddling farther under the blanket.
Really?
Yeah, I said. Nobody talks about this kind of thing, but all those people are still gone. Maybe a lot of them just cut their ties and left their old lives behind. Maybe some were in accidents of some kind, with the body never found. The point is, people don't know. But because it's an extremely scary thing to think about, and because it's a lot easier to just get back to their lives, they tend to dismiss it. Ignore it. It's easier. Butters shook his head.
It just sounds so insane. I mean, they'd believe it if they saw it. If someone went on television and...
Did what? I asked. Bent spoons? Maybe made the Statue of Liberty disappear? Turned a lady into a white tiger? Hell, I've done magic on television, and everyone not screaming that it was a hoax was complaining that the special effects looked cheap.
You mean that clip that WGN News was showing a few years back, with you and Murphy and the big dog and that insane guy with a club?
It wasn't a dog, I said, and shivered a little myself at the memory. It was a Lou Guru, kind of a super werewolf. I killed him with a spell and a silver amulet right on the screen.
Yeah. Everyone was talking about it for a couple of days, but I heard that they found out it was a fake or something.